She comes into the school with us. Mr. O'Neill looks cross and tells us, sit down, he'll be with us in a minute. He talks a long time at the door with my mother, and when she leaves, he walks between the seats and pats Paddy Clossie on the head. I'm very sorry for the Clossies and all their troubles, but I think they saved me from getting into trouble with my mother. There are Thursdays when Dad gets his dole money at the Labour Exchange, and a man might say, will we go for a pint, Malachy? And Dad will say, one, only one. And the man will say, oh God, yes, one. And before the night is over, all the money is gone, and Dad comes home singing and getting us out of bed to line us up and promise to die for Ireland when the call comes. He even gets Michael up, and he's only three, but there he is singing and promising to die for Ireland at the first opportunity. That's what Dad calls it, the first opportunity. I'm nine, and Malachy is eight, and we know all the songs. We sing all the verses of Kevin Barry and Roddy McCauley, The West Asleep, O'Donnell Aboo, The Boys of Wexford. We sing and promise to die because you never know when Dad might have a penny or two left over from the drinking. And if he gives it to us, we can run to Kathleen O'Connell's next day for toffee. Some nights he says Michael is the best singer of all, and he gives him the penny. Malachy and I wonder, what's the use of being eight and nine and knowing all the songs and ready to die when Michael gets the penny so that he can go to the shop next day and stuff his gob with toffee galore? No one can ask him to die for Ireland at the age of three, not even Padraig Pearse, who was shot by the English in Dublin in 1916 and expected the whole world to die with him. Besides, Michael Molloy's father said, anyone who wants to die for Ireland is a donkey's arse. Men have been dying for Ireland since the beginning of time, and look at the state of the country. It's bad enough that Dad loses jobs in the third week, but now he drinks all the dole money once a month. Mam gets desperate, and in the morning she has the bitter face, and she won't talk to him. He has his tea and leaves the house early for the long walk into the country. When he returns in the evening, she still won't talk to him, and she won't make his tea. If the fire is dead for the want of coal or turf, and there's no way of boiling water for the tea, he says, "Ach aye," and drinks water out of a jam jar and smacks his lips the way he would with a pint of porter. He says good water is all a man needs, and Mam makes a snorting sound. When she's not talking to him, the house is heavy and cold, and we know we're not supposed to talk to him either, for fear she'll give us the bitter look. We know Dad has done the bad thing, and we know you can make anyone suffer by not talking to him. Even little Michael knows that when Dad does the bad thing, you don't talk to him from Friday to Monday. And when he tries to lift you to his lap, you run to Mam. I'm 9 years old, and I have a pal, Mickey Spellacy, whose relations are dropping one by one of the galloping consumption. I envy Mickey because every time someone dies in his family, he gets a week off from school and his mother stitches a black diamond patch on his sleeve so that he can wander from lane to lane and street to street and people will know he has the grief and pat his head and give him money and sweets for his sorrow. But this summer, Mickey is worried. His sister Brenda is wasting away with the consumption, and it's only August, and if she dies before September, he won't get his week off from school because you can't get a week off from school when there's no school. He comes to Billy Campbell and me to ask if we go around the corner to St. Joseph's Church and pray for Brenda to hang on till September. What's in it for us, Mickey, if we go around the corner praying? Well, if Brenda hangs on and I get me week off, ye can come to the wake and have ham and cheese and cake and sherry and lemonade and everything, and ye can listen to the songs and stories all night. Who could say no to that? There's nothing like a wake for having a good time. We trot around to the church where they have statues of St. Joseph himself, as well as the Sacred Heart of Jesus, the Virgin Mary, and St. Therese of Lisieux, the Little Flower. I pray to the Little Flower because she died of the consumption herself, and she'd understand. One of our prayers must have been powerful because Brenda stays alive and doesn't die till the second day of school. We tell Mickey we're sorry for his troubles, but he's delighted with his week off, and he gets the black diamond patch, which will bring the money and sweets. My mouth is watering at the thought of the feast at Brenda's wake. Billy knocks on the door, and there's Mickey's aunt.
Well?
We came to say a prayer for Brenda, and Mickey said we could come to the wake. She yells,
Mickey!
What?
Come here.
Did you tell this gang they could come to your sister's wake?
No.
But Mickey, you promised. She slams the door in our faces. We don't know what to do, till Billy Campbell says, We'll go back to St. Joseph's and pray that from now on, everyone in Mickey Spellis's family will die in the middle of the summer, and he'll never get a day off from school for the rest of his life. One of our prayers is surely powerful, because next summer, Mickey himself is carried off by the galloping consumption, and he doesn't get a day off from school, and that will surely teach him a lesson. Proddy Waddy, ring the bell, not for heaven, but for hell. On Sunday mornings in Limerick, I watch them go to church, the Protestants, and I feel sorry for them, especially the girls, who are so lovely, they have such beautiful white teeth. I feel sorry for all the beautiful Protestant girls, they're doomed. That's what the priests tell us. Outside the Catholic Church, there is no salvation. Outside the Catholic Church, there is nothing but doom. And I want to save them. Protestant girl, come with me to the true church. You'll be saved and you won't have the doom. After Mass on Sunday, I go with my friend Billy Campbell to watch them play croquet on the lovely lawn beside their church on Barrington Street. Croquet is a Protestant game. They hit the ball with the mallet, pock and pock again, and laugh. I wonder how they can laugh, or don't they even know they're doomed? I feel sorry for them and I say, Billy, what's the use of playing croquet when you're doomed? He says, Frankie, what's the use of not playing croquet when you're doomed? Grandma says to Mam, Your brother Pat, bad leg and all, was selling papers all over Limerick by the time he was 8, and that Frank of yours is big and ugly enough to work.
But he's only 9 and still in school.
School? 'Tis school that has him the way he is, talking back and going around with the sour puss in the odd manner, like his father. He could get out and help poor Pat of a Friday night when the Limerick leader is a ton weight. He could run up the long garden paths of the quality and save Pat's poor legs and earn a few pennies into the bargain.
He has to go to the confraternity on Friday nights. Never mind the confraternity. There's nothing in the catechism about confraternities.
I meet Uncle Pat at the Limerick Leader on Friday evening at 5. The man handing out the paper says my arms are that skinny, I'd be lucky to carry 2 stamps. But Uncle Pat sticks 8 papers under each arm. He tells me, I'll kill you if you drop them, for 'tis raining abroad, pelting out of the heavens. He tells me, hug the walls going up O'Connell Street to keep the papers dry. I'm to run in where there's a delivery, climb the outside steps, in the door, up the stairs, yell, Paper! Get the money they owe him for the week, down the stairs, give him the money, and on to the next stop. Customers give him tips for his troubles, and he keeps them for himself. We make our way up O'Connell Avenue, out Ballinacurra, in by the South Circular Road, down Henry Street, and back to the office for more papers. Uncle Pat wears a cap and a thing like a cowboy poncho to keep his papers dry, but he complains his feet are killing him, and we stop in a pub for a pint for his poor feet. Uncle Pat Keating is there, all black and having a pint, and he says to Uncle Pat, Ab, are you going to let that boy stand there with his face hanging out for the want of a lemonade? Uncle Pat says, What? And Uncle Pat Keating gets impatient. Christ! He's dragging your feckin' papers all over Limerick and you can't. Oh, never mind. Timmy, give the child the lemonade. Frankie, don't you have a raincoat at home? No, Uncle Pa. You're not supposed to be out in this weather. You're drenched entirely. Who sent you out in this muck?
Grandma said I had to help Uncle Pat because of his bad leg.
Course she did, the old bitch. But don't tell them I say that.
Uncle Pat is struggling off the seat and gathering up his papers.
Come on, 'tis getting dark.
He hobbles along the street calling,
"And a lie, sweet lie,"
which doesn't sound a bit like Limerick Leader, and it doesn't matter because everyone knows this is Ab Sheehan that was dropped in his head.
"Here, Ab, give us a leader. How's your poor leg? Keep the change and get yourself a fag, for 'tis an awful feckin' night to be out selling the feckin' papers."
"Thanks," says Ab, my uncle. "Thanks, thanks, thanks." And it's hard to keep up with him on the street, bad as his leg is. He says,
"How many leaders have you under your oxter?"
"One, Uncle Pat."
"Take that leader into Mr. Timoney. He owes me for a fortnight now. Get that money, and there's a tip. He's a good man for the tip, and don't be shoving it in your pocket like your cousin Jerry. Shoved it in his pocket, the little bugger."
I bang on the door with the knocker, and there's a great howl from a dog so big he makes the door shake. A man's voice says,
"Macushla, quit the bloody racket or I'll give you a good fong in the arse for yourself."
The racket stops, the door opens, and the man is there. White hair, thick glasses, white sweater, a stick in his hand. He says,
"Who is it? Who do we have?"
"The paper, Mr. Timoney."
"We don't have Ab Sheehan here, do we?"
"I'm his nephew, sir."
"Is it Jerry Sheehan we have here?"
"No, sir. I'm Frank McCourt."
"Another nephew? Does he make them? Is there a little nephew factory in the backyard? Here's the money for the fortnight, and give me the paper, or keep it. What's the use? I can't read any more. And Mrs. Minahan, that's supposed to read to me, didn't come. Legless with the sherry, that's what she is. What's your name?"
"Frank, sir."
"Can you read?"
"I can, sir."
"Do you want to earn the sixpence?"
"I do, sir."
"Come here tomorrow. Your name is Francis, isn't it?"
"Frank, sir."
"Your name is Francis. There was never a Saint Frank. That's a name for gangsters and politicians. Come here tomorrow at 11 and read to me."
"I will, sir."
"Are you sure you can read?"
"I am, sir."
"You can call me Mr. Timoney."
"I will, Mr. Timoney."
Uncle Pat is mumbling at the gate, rubbing his leg.
"Where's me money? And you're not supposed to be chatting with the customers and me here with the leg destroyed by the rain."
He has to stop at the pub at Punch's Cross to have a pint for the destroyed leg. After the pint, he says he can't walk another inch, and we get on a bus. The conductor says,
"Fares, please, fares." But Uncle Pat says, "Go away and don't be bothering me. Can't you see the state of me leg?"
"Oh, all right, Ab, all right." The bus stops at the O'Connell Monument, and Uncle Pat goes to the Monument Fish and Chip Cafe, where the smells are so delicious my stomach beats with the hunger. He gets a shilling's worth of fish and chips, and my mouth is watering. But when we get to Grandma's door, he gives me a threepenny bit, tells me meet him again next Friday, and go home now to my mother. The dog, Macushla, is lying outside Mr. Timoney's door, and when I open the little garden gate to go up the path, she rushes at me and knocks me back out on the pavement, and she'd eat my face if Mr. Timoney didn't come out and flail at her with his stick and yell,
"Come in out of it, you whore, you overgrown, man-eating bitch. Didn't you have your breakfast, you whore? Are you all right, Francis? Come in." "That dog is a right Hindu, so she is. And that's where I found her mother, wandering around Bangalore. If you're ever getting a dog, Francis, make sure it's a Buddhist. Good-natured dogs, the Buddhists. Never get a Mohammedan. They'll eat you sleeping. Never a Catholic dog. They'll eat you every day, including Fridays. Sit down and read to me."
"The Limerick Leader, Mr. Timoney?"
No, not the bloody Limerick Leader. I wouldn't wipe the whole of my arse with the Limerick Leader. There's a book over there on the table, Gulliver's Travels. That's not what I want you to read. Look in the back for another thing. A Modest Proposal. Read that to me. It begins, "It is a melancholy object to those who walk." Do you have that? I have the whole bloody thing in my head, but I still want you to read to me.
He stops me after two or three pages.
You're a good reader. What do you think of that, Francis? That a healthy young child, well nursed, is at a year old the most delicious, nourishing and wholesome food, whether stewed, roasted, baked or boiled, eh? Macushla would love a dinner of a nice, plump Irish infant. Wouldn't you, you old whore?
He gives me sixpence and tells me return next Saturday. Ma'am is delighted I earned sixpence for reading to Mr. Timoney. And what was it he wanted read? The Limerick Leader? I tell her I had to read A Modest Proposal from the back of Gulliver's Travels, and she says, "That's all right, 'tis only a children's book." You'd expect him to want something strange, for he's little off in the head after years in the sun in the English army in India. And they say he was married to one of them Indian women, and she was accidentally shot by a soldier during some class of a disturbance. That's the kind of thing that would drive you to children's books. She knows this Mrs. Minahan, who lives next door to Mr. Timoney, and used to clean house but couldn't stand it anymore, the way he laughed at the Catholic Church and said one man's sin was another man's romp. Mrs. Minahan didn't mind the odd drop of sherry of a Saturday morning, but then he tried to turn her into a Buddhist, which he said he was himself, and the Irish would be much better off in general if they sat under a tree and watched the Ten Commandments and the Seven Deadly Sins float down the Shannon and far out to sea. The next Friday, Declan Colopy from the confraternity sees me on the street delivering the papers with my uncle Pat Sheehan.
"Hi, Frankie McCourt. What are you doing with Ab Sheehan?"
"He's my uncle."
"You're supposed to be at the confraternity."
"I'm working, Declan."
"You're not supposed to be working. You're not even 10. And you're destroying the perfect attendance in our section. If you're not there next Friday, I'll give you a good thump in the gob. Do you hear me?"
Uncle Pat says, "Go away. Go away or I'll walk on you."
"Ah, shut up, Mr. Stupid, that was dropped in your head."
He pushes Uncle Pat on the shoulder and knocks him back against the wall. I drop the papers and run at him, but he steps aside and punches me on the back of the neck, and my forehead is rammed into the wall, and it puts me in such a rage I can't see him anymore. I go at him with arms and legs, and if I could tear his face off with my teeth, I would. But he has long arms like a gorilla, and he just keeps pushing me away so that I can't touch him. He says, "You mad feckin' Egypt, I'll destroy you in the confraternity." And he runs away. Uncle Pat says, "You shouldn't be fighting like that. And you dropped all me papers, and some of them is wet. And how am I supposed to sell wet papers?" And I want to jump on him too and hit him for talking about papers after I stood up to Declan Colopy. At the end of the night, he gives me 3 chips from his bag and sixpence instead of 3 pence. He complains it's too much money and it's all my mother's fault for going out to Grandma about the low pay. Ma'am is delighted I'm getting sixpence on Fridays from Uncle Pat and sixpence on Saturdays from Mr. Timoney. A shilling a week makes a big difference, and she gives me tuppence to see the dead-end kids at the Lyric after I'm finished the reading. Next morning, Mr. Timoney says,
"Wait till we get to Gulliver, Francis. You'll know Jonathan Swift is the greatest Irish writer that ever lived. No, the greatest man to put pen to parchment. A giant of a man, Francis."
He laughs all through A Modest Proposal, and you'd wonder what he's laughing at when it's all about cooking Irish babies. He says,
"You'll laugh when you grow up, Francis."
You're not supposed to talk back to grown-ups, but Mr. Timoney is different, and he doesn't mind when I say, "Mr. Timoney, big people are always telling us that. Oh, you'll laugh when you grow up. You'll understand when you grow up. Everything will come when you grow up." He lets out such a roar of a laugh, I think he's going to collapse.
"Ah, Mother of God, Francis, you're a treasure. What's up with you? Do you have a bee up your arse? Tell me what's up.
Nothing, Mr. Timoney.
I think you have the long puss, Francis, and I wish I could see it. Go over to the mirror on the wall, Snow White, and tell me if you have the long puss. Never mind. Just tell me what's up.
Declan Colopy was at me last night, and I got into a fight. He makes me tell him about the confraternity and Declan and my Uncle Pat Sheehan, who was dropped in his head. And then he tells me he knows my Uncle Pat Keating, who was gassed in the war, and works in the gas works. He says,
Pat Keating is a jewel of a man. And I'll tell you what I'll do, Francis. I'll talk to Pat Keating, and we'll go to the craw thumpers at the confraternity. I'm a Buddhist myself, and I don't hold with fighting, but I haven't lost it. They're not going to interfere with my little reader, oh, by Jesus, no.
Mr. Timoney is an old man, but he talks like a friend, and I can say what I feel. Dad would never talk to me like Mr. Timoney. He'd say, ah, hi, and go for a long walk. Uncle Pat Sheehan tells Grandma he doesn't want me to help with the papers anymore. He can get another boy much cheaper, and he thinks I should be giving him some of my Saturday morning sixpence anyway, since I'd never have the reading job without him. A woman next door to Mr. Timoney tells me I'm wasting my time knocking on the door. McCoskler bit the postman, the milkman, and a passing nun on the same day, and Mr. Timoney couldn't stop laughing, though he cried when the dog was taken away to be put down. You can bite postman and milkman all you like, but the case of the passing nun goes all the way to the bishop, and he takes steps, especially if the owner of the dog is a known Buddhist and a danger to good Catholics around him. Mr. Timoney was told this and laughed and cried so hard the doctor came and said he was gone beyond recall, so they carted him off to the city home where they keep all people who are helpless or demented. That's the end of my Saturday sixpence. But I'll write to Mr. Timoney, money or no money. I wait down the street till the woman next door goes in. I climb in Mr. Timoney's window for Gulliver's Travels and walk miles to the city home so that he won't miss his reading. The man at the gate says, what? You want to come in and read to an old man? Is it cotton me you are? Get out of here before I call the guards. Could I leave the book for someone else to read to Mr. Timoney? Leave it. Leave it for Jesus' sake and don't be bothering me. I'll send it up to him. And he laughs. Ma'am says, what's up with you? Why are you moping? And I tell her how Uncle Pat doesn't want me anymore and how they put Mr. Timoney in the city home for laughing just because McCoskler bit the postman, the milkman, and a passing nun. She laughs too, and I'm sure the world has gone mad. Then she says, I'm sorry, and it's a pity you lost two jobs. You might as well start going to the confraternity again to keep the posse away, and worse, the director, Father Gorey. Declan tells me sit in front of him, and if there's any blackguarding, he'll break my feckin' neck, for he'll be watching me as long as he's prefect, and no little shit like me is going to keep him from a life in linoleum. Ma'am says she has trouble climbing the stairs and she's moving her bed to the kitchen. She laughs. I'll come back up to Sorrento when the walls are damp and the rain runs under the door. School is over, and she can stay in bed in the kitchen as long as she likes, because she doesn't have to get up for us. Dad lights the fire, makes the tea, cuts the bread, makes sure we wash our faces, and tells us go out and play. He lets us stay in bed if we like, but you never want to stay in bed when there's no school. We're ready to run out and play in the lane the minute we wake. Then one day in July, he says we can't go downstairs. We have to stay up here and play. Why, Dad? Never mind. Play here with Malachi and Michael, and you can go down later when I tell you. He stands at the door in case we might get a notion to wander down the stairs. We push our blanket up in the air with our feet and pretend we're in a tent. Robin Hood and his merry men. We hunt fleas and squash them between our thumbnails. Then there's a baby's cry and Malachi says, Dad, did Mam get a new baby? Ach, aye, son. I'm older. So I tell Malachy the bed is in the kitchen so that the angel can fly down and leave the baby on the seventh step. But Malachy doesn't understand because he's only 8 going on 9. And I'll be 10 next month. Mam is in the bed with a new baby. He has a big fat face and he's red all over. There's a woman in the kitchen in a nurse's uniform, and we know she's there to wash new babies who are always dirty from the long journey with the angel. We want to tickle the baby, but she says, "No, no, you can look at him, but don't lay a finger." Don't lay a finger. That's the way nurses talk. We sit at the table with our tea and bread, looking at our new brother, but he won't even open his eyes to look back at us, so we go out and play. In a few days, Mam is out of the bed, holding the baby on her lap by the fire. His eyes are open, and when we tickle him, he makes a gurgling sound. His belly shakes, and that makes us laugh. Dad tickles him and sings a Scottish song. "Oh, stop your tickling, Jock. Stop your tickling, Jock. Stop your tickling, ickle-ickle-ickling. Stop your tickling, Jock." Dad has a job, so Bridie Hannon is able to visit Mam and the baby any time she likes, and for once, Mam doesn't tell us go out and play, so they can talk about secret things. They sit by the fire smoking and talking about names. Mam says she likes the names Kevin and Sean, but Bridie says, "Ah, no, there's too many of them in Limerick. Jesus, Angela, if you stuck your head out the door and called, 'Kevin or Sean, come in for your tea,' you'd have half a Limerick running to your door." Bridie says if she had a son, which, please God, she will someday, she'd call him Ronald, because she's mad about Ronald Coleman that you see in the Coliseum cinema. Or Errol. Now that's another lovely name. Errol Flynn. Mam says, "Will you go way out of that, Bridie? I'd never be able to stick my head out the door and say, 'Errol, Errol, come in for your tea.' Sure, the poor child would be a laughingstock." "Ronald," says Bridie, "Ronald, he's gorgeous." "No," says Mam, "it has to be Irish. Isn't that what we fought for all these years? What's the use of fighting the English for centuries if we're going to call our children Ronald?" "Jesus, Angela, you're starting to talk like himself with his Irish this and his English that." "Still and all, Bridie, he's right." Suddenly Bridie is gasping. "Jesus, Angela, there's something wrong with that child." Mam is out of the chair, hugging the child, moaning. "Oh, Jesus, Bridie, he's choking." Bridie says, "I'll run for my mother," and she's back in a minute with Mrs. Hannon. "Castor oil," says Mrs. Hannon. "Do you have it? Any oil, cod liver oil, that'll do." She pours the oil into the baby's mouth, turns him over, presses on his back, turns him back over, sticks a spoon down his throat and brings up a white ball. "That's it now," she says. "The milk. It collects and gets hard in the little throat, so you have to ease it with any class of an oil." Mam is crying. "Jesus, I nearly lost him. Oh, I'd die so I would." She's clutching the baby and crying and trying to thank Mrs. Hannon. "Yerra, don't mention it, Mrs. Take the child and get back into that bed, for the two of you had a great shock." While Bridie and Mrs. Hannon are helping Mam to the bed, I notice spots of blood on her chair. Is my mother bleeding to death? Is it all right to say, "Look, there's blood on Mam's chair"? No, you can't say anything because they always have secrets. I know if you say anything, the grown-up people will tell you, "Never mind, you're always gawking, none of your business, go out and play." I have to keep it inside, or I can talk to the angel. Mrs. Hannon and Bridie leave, and I sit on the seventh step. I try to tell the angel Mam is bleeding to death. I want him to tell me, "Fear not." But the step is cold, and there's no light, no voice. I'm sure he's gone forever. And I wonder if that happens when you go from 9 to 10. Mam doesn't bleed to death. She's out of the bed next day, getting the baby ready for baptism, telling Bridie she could never forgive herself if the baby died and went to limbo, a place for unbaptized babies, where it may be nice and warm, but still dark forever, and no hope of escape even on the judgment day. Grandma is there to help, and she says, "That's right. No hope in heaven for an infant that's not baptized." Bridie says it would be a hard God that would do the likes of that. He has to be hard, says Grandma. Otherwise you'd have all kinds of babies clamouring to get into heaven, Protestants and everything. And why should they get in after what they did to us for 800 years? The babies didn't do it, says Bridie. They're too small. They would if they got the chance, says Grandma. They're trained for it. They dressed the baby in the Limerick lace dress we were all baptised in. Mam says we can all go to St. Joseph's, and we're excited because there will be lemonade and buns after. Maliki says, Mam, what's the baby's name? Alphonsus Joseph. The words fly out of my mouth. That's a stupid name. It's not even Irish. Grandma glares at me with her old red eyes. She says, that fella needs a good clitter on the gob. Mam slaps me across the face and sends me flying across the kitchen. My heart is pounding and I want to cry, but I can't because my father isn't there and I'm the man of the family. Mam says, you go upstairs with your big mouth and don't move from that room. I stop at the seventh step, but it's still cold. No light. No voice. The house is quiet with everyone gone to the chapel. I sit and wait upstairs, knocking the fleas off my arms and legs, wishing I had Dad here, thinking of my little brother and his foreign name, Alphonsus, an affliction of a name. In a while there are voices downstairs, and there's talk of tea, sherry, lemonade, buns. And isn't that child the loveliest little fella in the world, little Alfie? Foreign name, but still and all, not a sound out of him the whole time. He's that good-natured, God bless him. Sure, he'll live forever with the sweetness that's in him, the little dolt, spitting image of his mother, his father, his grandma, his little brothers, dead and gone. Mam calls from the bottom of the stairs. Frank, come down and have lemonade and a bun.
I don't want it. You can keep it.
I said come down this minute. For if I have to climb these stairs, I'll warm you behind and you'll rue the day.
Rue? What's rue?
Never mind what's rue. Come down here at once.
Her voice is sharp and rue sounds dangerous. I'll go down.
In the kitchen, Grandma says, look at the long puss on him. You'd think he'd be happy for his little brother. Except that a boy that's gone from 9 to 10 is always a right pain in the arse. And I know, for didn't I have 2 of them?
The lemonade and bun are delicious, and Alfie, the new baby, is chirping away, enjoying his baptism day. Too innocent to know his name is an affliction. Grandpa in the north sends a telegram money order for £5 for the baby Alfie. Mam wants to cash it, but she can't go far from the bed. Dad says he'll cash it at the post office. She tells Maliki and me to go with him. He cashes it and tells us, all right, boys, go home and tell your mother. I'll be home in a few minutes. Maliki says,
Dad, you're not to go to the pub. Mam said you're to bring home the money. You're not to drink the pint.
Now, son, go home to your mother.
Dad, give us the money. That money is for the baby.
Now, Francis, don't be a bad boy. Do what your father tells you.
He walks away from us and into South's pub.
Mam is sitting by the fireplace with Alfie in her arms. She shakes her head.
He went to the pub, didn't he?
He did.
I want ye to go back down to that pub and read him out of it. I want ye to stand in the middle of the pub and tell every man your father is drinking the money for the baby. Ye are to tell the world there isn't a scrap of food in this house, not a lump of coal to start the fire, not a drop of milk for the baby's bottle.
We walk through the streets and Maliki practices speech at the top of his voice.
Dad, Dad, that £5 is for the new baby. That's not for the drink. The child is above in the bed bawling and roaring for his milk and you're drinking the pint.
He's gone from South's pub. Maliki still wants to stand and make his speech, but I tell him we have to hurry and look in other pubs before Dad drinks the whole £5. We can't find him in other pubs either. He knows Mam would come for him or send us, and there are so many pubs at this end of Limerick and beyond, we could be looking for a month.
We have to tell Mam there's no sign of him, and she tells us we're pure useless.
Oh, Jesus, I wish I had my strength and I'd search every pub in Limerick. I'd tear the mouth out of his head, so I would. Go on, go back down and try all the pubs around the railway station and try Nocton's Fish and Chip Shop.
I have to go by myself because Malachy has the runs and can't stray far from the bucket. I search all the pubs in Parnell Street and around. I look into the snugs where the women drink and in all the men's lavatories. I'm hungry, but I'm afraid to go home till I find my father.
He's not in Nocton's Fish and Chip Shop, but there's a drunken man asleep at a table in the corner, and his fish and chips are on the floor in the Limerick Leader wrapping, and if I don't get them, the cat will, so I shove them under my jersey, and I'm out the door and up the street to sit on the steps at the railway station, eat my fish and chips, watch the drunken soldiers pass by with the girls that giggle, thank the drunken man in my mind for drowning the fish and chips in vinegar and smothering them in salt. And then I remember that if I die tonight, I'm in a state of sin for stealing, and I could go straight to hell stuffed with fish and chips. But it's Saturday, and if the priests are still in the confession boxes, I can clear my soul after my feed. The Dominican church is just up Glentworth Street. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's a fortnight since my last confession. I tell him the usual sins, and then, I stole fish and chips from a drunken man, Father.
Why, my child?
I was hungry, Father.
And why were you hungry?
There was nothing in my belly, Father.
He says nothing. And even though it's dark, I know he's shaking his head. My dear child, why can't you go home and ask your mother for something?
Because she sent me out looking for my father in the pubs, Father.
And I couldn't find him, and she hasn't a scrap in the house, because he's drinking the 5 pounds Grandpa sent from the north for the new baby. And she's raging by the fire because I can't find my father.
I wonder if this priest is asleep, because he's very quiet, till he says,
my child, I sit here, I hear the sins of the poor, I assign the penance, I bestow absolution. I should be on my knees washing their feet. Do you understand me, my child? I tell him I do, but I don't. Go home, child. Pray for me.
No penance, Father?
No, my child.
I stole the fish and chips. I'm doomed.
You're forgiven. Go. Pray for me. He blesses me in Latin, talks to himself in English, and I wonder what I did to him. I wish I could find my father so I could say to Mam, here he is, and he has 3 pounds left in his pocket. I'm not hungry now, so I can go up one side of O'Connell Street and down the other, and search pubs and the side streets, and there he is in Gleason's. How could I miss him with his singing? 'Tis alone my concern, if the grandest surprise would be shining at me out of somebody's eyes. 'Tis my private affair what my feelings would be, while the green glens of Antrim were welcoming me. My heart is banging away in my chest, and I don't know what to do because I know I'm raging inside like my mother by the fire, and all I can think of doing is running in and giving him a good kick in the leg and running out again. But I don't. Because we have the mornings by the fire when he tells me about Cahoolan and De Valera and Roosevelt, and if he's there drunk and buying pints with the baby's money, he has that look in his eyes Eugene had when he searched for Oliver, and I might as well go home and tell my mother a lie that I never saw him, couldn't find him. She's in the bed with the baby. Malachy and Michael are up in Italy asleep. I know I don't have to tell Mam anything, that soon when the pubs close he'll be home singing and offering us a penny to die for Ireland. And it will be different now because it's bad enough to drink the dole or the wages, but a man that drinks the money for a new baby is gone beyond the beyonds, as my mother would say.
I'm 10 years old and ready to go to St. Joseph's Church for my confirmation. In school, the master, Mr. O'D, prepares us. We have to know all about sanctifying grace, a pearl of great price, bought for us by Jesus in his dying. Mr. O'D's eyes roll in his head when he tells us that with confirmation we will become part of divinity. We will have the gifts of the Holy Ghost, wisdom, understanding, counsel, fortitude, knowledge, piety, the fear of the Lord. Priests and masters tell us confirmation means you're a true soldier of the church, and that entitles you to die and be a martyr in case we're invaded by Protestants or Mohammedans or any other class of a heathen. More dying. I want to tell them I won't be able to die for the faith because I'm already booked to die for Ireland. Micah Malloy says, "Is it joking you are? That thing about dying for the faith is all a cod. 'Tis only a saying they made up to frighten you. Ireland too. No one dies for anything anymore. All the dying is done. I wouldn't die for Ireland or the faith. I might die for my mother, but that's all." Mikey knows everything. He's going on 14. He gets the fits. He has visions. The grown-ups tell us it's a glorious thing to die for the faith, only we're not ready for that yet because Confirmation Day is like First Communion Day. You make the rounds of lanes and back streets, and you get cakes and sweets and money. The collection. That's where poor Peter Dooley comes in. We call him Quasimodo because he has a hump in his back, like the one on the Hunchback of Notre Dame, whose real name, we know, is Charles Lawton. Quasimodo has 9 sisters, and it's said his mother never wanted him, but that's what the angel brought her, and it's a sin to question what's sent. Quasimodo is old. He's 15. His red hair sticks up in all directions. He has green eyes, and one rolls around in his head so much he's constantly tapping his temple to keep it where it's supposed to be. His right leg is short and twisted, and when he walks he does a little twirly dance, and you never know when he'll fall. That's when you're surprised. He curses his leg. He curses the world. But he curses in a lovely English accent, which he got from the radio, the BBC. Before he leaves his house, he always sticks his head out the door and tells the lane, "Here's me head, me arse is coming." When he was 12, Quasimodo decided that with the way he looked and the way the world looked at him, the best thing would be to prepare for a job where he could be heard and not seen. And what better than sitting behind a microphone at the BBC in London reading the news? But you can't get to London without money. And that's why he hobbles up to us that Friday, the day before confirmation. He has an idea for Billy and me. He knows the next day we'll be getting confirmation money, and if we promise to pay him a shilling each, he let us climb up the rain spout behind his house this very night to look in the window and see his sisters' naked bodies when they take their weekly wash. I sign right away. Billy says, "I have my own sister. Why should I pay to see your naked sisters?" Quasimodo says that looking at your own sister's naked body is the worst sin of all, and he's not sure if there's a priest in the world can forgive you, that you might have to go to the bishop, who everyone knows is a holy terror. Billy signs. Friday night we climb the wall of Quasimodo's backyard. It's a lovely night with the June moon floating high over Limerick, and you can feel a warm breeze off the Shannon River. Quasimodo is about to let Billy up the spout, and who comes clambering over the wall but Mikey Malloy the Fit himself, hissing at Quasimodo, "Here's a shilling, Quasimodo, let me up the spout." Mikey is 14 now, bigger than any of us, and strong from his job delivering coal. He's black from the coal, like Uncle Pat Keating, and all you can see are the whites of his eyes and the white froth on his lower lip, which means he could have the fit any time. Quasimodo says, "Wait, Mikey, there first." "Wait my arse," says Mikey, and he's away up the spout. Billy complains, but Quasimodo shakes his head. "I can't help it. He comes here every week with a shilling. I have to let him up the spout, or he'll beat me up and tell my mother, and the next thing she locks me in the coal hole all day with the rats."
The fit is up, hanging onto the spout with one hand. The other hand is in his pocket, moving, moving, and when the spout itself starts to move and creak, Quasimodo hisses,
"Malloy, there's to be no wanking up the spout."
He hops around the yard, cackling. His BBC accent is gone, and he's pure Limerick.
"Jesus, Malloy, come down off that spout, or I'll tell me mother."
Mikey's hand goes faster in his pocket, so fast the spout gives a lurch and collapses, and Mikey is rolling on the ground, yelping,
"I'm dead, I'm destroyed, oh God."
You could see the froth on his lips and the blood that comes from biting his tongue. Quasimodo's mother comes screaming through the door.
"What in the name of Jesus?"
And the light fills the yard. The sisters are squawking from the window above. Billy tries to escape and she drags him off the wall. She tells him to run to O'Connor, the chemist around the corner, to ring up an ambulance or a doctor or something for Mikey. She screams at us to get into the kitchen. She kicks Quasimodo into the hall. He's on his hands and knees and she drags him to the coal hole under the stairs and locks him in.
"Stay there till you come to your senses."
He's crying and calling to her in a pure Limerick accent.
"Ah, Mama, Mama, let me out. The rats is here. I only want to go to the BBC, Mama. Ah, Jesus, Mama, Jesus. I'll never let anyone up the spout again. I'll send money from London, Mama, Mama."
Mikey is still on his back, jerking and twisting around the yard. The ambulance takes him off to the hospital with a broken shoulder and his tongue in ribbons. Our mothers are there in no time. Mrs. Dooley says,
"I'm disgraced, I am disgraced. My daughters can't wash themselves of a Friday night without the whole world gawking in the window. And them boys there are in a state of sin and should be taken to the priest for confession before their confirmation tomorrow."
But Mam says,
"I don't know about the rest of the world, but I saved a whole year for Frank's confirmation suit, and I'm not going to the priest to have him tell me my son is not fit for confirmation, so that I'll have to wait another year when he grows out of this suit, and all because he climbed the spout for an innocent gawk at the scrawny arse of Mona Dooley."
She drags me home by the ear and makes me kneel before the Pope.
"Swear," she says, "swear to that Pope that you didn't look at Mona Dooley in her pelt."
"I swear."
"If you're lying, you won't be in a state of grace for confirmation tomorrow. And that's the worst kind of sacrilege."
"I swear."
"Only the bishop himself could forgive a sacrilege like that."
"I swear."
"All right, go to bed. And from this day out, stay far away from that misfortunate Quasimodo Dooley."
We're all confirmed the next day. The bishop asks me a catechism question. What is the fourth commandment? And I tell him, "Honour thy father and thy mother." He pats my cheek, and that makes me a soldier of the true church. I kneel in the pew and think of Quasimodo locked in the coal hole under the stairs, and I wonder, should I give him the shilling anyway for his career at the BBC? But I forget all about Quasimodo because my nose starts bleeding and I feel dizzy. Confirmation boys and girls are outside St. Joseph's with their parents, and there's hugging and kissing in the bright sun, and I don't care. My father's working, and I don't care. My mother kisses me, and I don't care. The boys talk about the collection, and I don't care. My nose won't stop, and Mam is worried I'll ruin my suit. She runs into the church to see if Stephen Carey, the sacristan, would spare her a rag, and he gives her some kind of canvas cloth that makes my nose sore. She says, "Do you want to make your collection?" And I tell her, "I don't care." Maliki says, do, Frankie." And he's sad because I promised I'd take him to the Lyric Cinema to see the film and stuff ourselves with sweets. I want to lie down. I could lie down there on the steps of St. Joseph's and sleep forever. Mam says, "Grandma is making a nice breakfast." And the mention of food makes me so sick I run to the edge of the pavement to throw up, and the whole world is looking at me, and I don't care. Mam says she'd better take me home or put me to bed, and my pals look surprised that anyone could go to bed when there's a collection to be made. She helps me take off my confirmation suit and puts me to bed.
She wets a rag and places it under my neck, and after a while, the bleeding stops. She brings tea, but the look of it makes me sick, and I have to throw up in the bucket. Mrs. Hannon comes in from next door, and I can hear her say, "That's a very sick child, and he should have a doctor." Ma'am says, "It's Saturday. The dispensary is closed. And where would you get a doctor?" Dad comes home from his job at Rank's Flour Mills and tells Ma'am I'm going through a stage. Growing pains. Grandma comes up and says the same thing. She says that when boys go from the one number a year, which is 9, to the two number a year, which is 10, they're changing and prone to the nosebleed. She says I might have too much blood in me anyway, and a good cleaning out wouldn't do me one bit of harm. The day passes, and I'm in and out of sleep. Maliki and Michael come into the bed at night, and I can hear Maliki say, "Frankie is very hot." Michael says, "He's bleeding on my leg." Ma'am puts the wet rag on my nose and a key on my neck. But it won't stop the bleeding. On Sunday morning, there's blood on my chest and all around me. Ma'am tells Dad I'm bleeding through my bottom, and he says I might have a case of the runs, which is common with the growing pains. Dr. Troy is our doctor, but he's away on holiday, and the man that comes to see me on Monday has a smell of whiskey on him. He examines me and tells my mother I have a bad cold and keep me in bed. Days pass, and I sleep and bleed. Ma'am makes tea and beef tea, and I don't want it. She even brings ice cream, and the look of it makes me sick. Mrs. Hannon comes in again and says, "That doctor doesn't know what he's talking about. See if Dr. Troy is back." Ma'am comes with Dr. Troy. He feels my forehead, rolls up my eyelids, turns me over to see my back, picks me up, and runs to his motor car. Ma'am runs after him, and he tells her I have typhoid fever. Ma'am cries, oh God, am I to lose the whole family? Would it ever end?" She gets into the car, holds me in her lap, and moans all the way to the fever hospital at the city home. The bed has cool white sheets. The nurses have clean white uniforms, and the nun, Sister Rita, is all in white. Dr. Humphrey and Dr. Campbell have white coats and things hanging from their necks, which they stick against my chest and all over. I sleep and sleep, but I'm awake when they bring in jars of bright red stuff that hang from tall poles above my bed, and they stick tubes into my ankles in the back of my right hand. Sister Rita says, "You're getting blood, Francis. Soldier's blood from the Sarsfield barracks." Ma'am is sitting by the bed, and the nurse is saying, "You know, missus, this is very unusual. No one is ever allowed into the fever hospital for fear they catch something, but they made an exception for you with his crisis coming. If he gets over this, he'll surely recover." I fall asleep. Ma'am is gone when I wake, but there's a movement in the room, and it's the priest, Father Gorey from the confraternity, saying mass at a table in the corner. I drift off again, and now they're waking me and pulling down the bedclothes. Father Gorey is touching me with oil and praying in Latin. I know it's extreme unction, and that means I'm going to die, and I don't care. They wake me again to receive communion. I don't want it. I'm afraid I might get sick. I keep the wafer on my tongue and fall asleep. And when I wake up again, it's gone. It's dark, and Dr. Campbell is sitting by my bed. He's holding my wrist and looking at his watch. He has red hair and glasses, and he always smiles when he talks to me. He sits now and hums and looks out the window. His eyes close, and he snores a little. He tilts over on the chair and farts and smiles to himself. And I know now I'm going to get better, because a doctor would never fart in the presence of a dying boy. Sister Rita's white habit is bright in the sun that comes in the window. She's holding my wrist, looking at her watch, smiling. "Oh," she says, "we're awake, are we? Well, Francis, I think we've come through the worst. Our prayers are answered, and all the prayers of those hundreds of little boys of the confraternity. Can you imagine that? Hundreds of boys saying the rosary for you and offering up their communion." My ankles and the back of my hand are throbbing from the tubes bringing in the blood, and I don't care about boys praying for me. I can hear the swish of Sister Rita's habit and the click of her rosary beads when she leaves the room. I fall asleep, and when I wake it's dark and Dad is sitting by the bed with his hand on mine.
Son, are you awake? I try to talk, but I'm dry. Nothing will come out, and I point to my mouth. He holds a glass of water to my lips, and it's sweet and cool. He presses my hand and says I'm a great old soldier, and why wouldn't I? Don't I have the soldier's blood in me? The tubes are not in me anymore, and the glass jars are gone. Sister Rita comes in and tells Dad he has to go. I don't want him to go because he looks sad. He's like Paddy Clossy the day I gave him the raisin. When he looks sad, it's the worst thing in the world, and I start crying. Now what's this, says Sister Rita, crying with all that soldier blood in you? There's a big surprise for you tomorrow, Francis. You'll never guess. Well, I'll tell you. We're bringing you a nice biscuit with your tea in the morning. Isn't that a treat? And your father will be back in a day or two. Won't you, Mr. McCourt? Dad nods and puts his hand in mine again. He looks at me, steps away, stops, comes back, kisses me on the forehead for the first time in my life, and I'm so happy I feel like floating out of the bed. The other two beds in my room are empty. The nurse says I'm the only typhoid patient, and I'm a miracle for getting over the crisis. The room next to me is empty, till one morning a girl's voice says, "Yoo-hoo! Who's there?" I'm not sure if she's talking to me or someone in the room beyond. "Yoo-hoo! Boy with the typhoid, are you awake?" "I am." "Are you better?" "I am." "Well, why are you here?" "I don't know. I'm still in the bed. They stick needles in me and give me medicine." "What do you look like?" "I wonder, what kind of question is that? I don't know what to tell her." "Yoo-hoo! Are you there, typhoid boy?" "I am." "What's your name?" "Frank." "That's a good name." "My name is Patricia Madigan. How old are you?"
10.
"Oh."
She sounds disappointed. "But I'll be 11 in August, next month."
"Well, that's better than 10. I'll be 14 in September. Do you want to know why I'm in the fever hospital?"
"I do."
"I have diphtheria and something else."
"What's something else?"
"They don't know. They think I have a disease from foreign parts because my father used to be in Africa. I nearly died. Are you going to tell me what you look like?"
"I have black hair."
"You and millions."
"I have brown eyes with bits of green that's called hazel."
"You and thousands."
"I have stitches on the back of my right hand and my 2 feet where they put in the soldier's blood."
"Oh, God, did they?"
"They did."
"You won't be able to stop marching and saluting."
There's a swish of habit and click of beads, and then Sister Rita's voice.
"Now, now, what's this? There's to be no talking between two rooms, especially when it's a boy and a girl. Do you hear me, Patricia?"
"I do, sister."
"Do you hear me, Francis?"
"I do, sister."
"You could be giving thanks for your two remarkable recoveries. You could be saying the rosary. You could be reading the little messenger of the Sacred Heart that's beside your beds. Don't let me come back and find you talking."
She comes into my room and wags her finger at me.
"Especially you, Francis. After thousands of boys prayed for you at the confraternity, give thanks, Francis, give thanks."
She leaves, and there's silence for a while. Then Patricia whispers,
"Give thanks, Francis, give thanks, and say your rosary, Francis." And I laugh so hard, and nurse runs in to see if I'm all right. She's a very stern nurse from the County Kerry, and she frightens me. "What's this, Francis? Laughing? What is there to laugh about? Are you and that Madigan girl talking? I'll report you to Sister Rita." "There's to be no laughing, for you could be doing serious damage to your internal apparatus.
She plods out, and Patricia whispers again in a heavy Kerry accent,
No laughing, Francis. You could